I'm Ian Williams. I'm president of the Foreign Press Association, and it's a timely. I'm very grateful to Elliot to come along. When we decided this, the crisis was looming, but it hadn't actually broken yet. And Elliot was one of the founders of Bellingcat, which has been tracking the InfoWars, and we've seen some of the results of this. I mean, what are the Keystone Commissars up to? I mean, their propaganda, their false flags are so patently obvious and silly. I mean, it's straight out of Monty Python, some of it, you know. bodies in cars with neat squares taken out by autopsy from the skulls of the alleged explosion victims, finished video from 5 years ago. Perhaps you can fill us in. Why do they want to do this? Who is their audience? Is it domestic Russia, or is it just their own consciences, or just a finger to the useful idiots in the West? If you believe this, you'll believe anything.
I think primarily it has been the Russian audience more than anything, because if you watch at how these things are reported on TV in Russia, they're reported unquestionably. They don't highlight any of the issues with some of this stuff. So, you know, one example of that is we had this video that was being shared by the PR department of the Odessa-based separatists, as they call themselves. That was also shared by the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic. But because they've recently moved on to sharing stuff more on Telegram, what they don't seem to realize is Telegram retains metadata, unlike Twitter and Facebook and other social media websites. So the file itself actually had all the metadata that showed how it had been edited from Adobe. So it used XMP, which is a specific kind of metadata associated with that, which basically broke down not only the source file that had been used, but for the audio, but the target file that had been used with the video in it, which is the video that we eventually saw, the exact moment it had been edited to add explosions to it, where those explosions had come from. And that also allowed us to do a waveform analysis of the explosions in each video that show that they were the same explosions, and it was certainly true. And it was as if they'd given us the kind of fake along with the blueprint for how they made the fake, and then said, kind of, you know, please believe us. But that was spread very widely on Russian television. It was absolutely everywhere. It's just one of many, many things. I mean, there's one video we saw yesterday where a Russian journalist claimed to have been attacked. You know, there was an artillery strike nearby, but it was very clearly just like a planted explosive that had gone off, you know, to create something for the news. It's notable that the cameraman didn't shake when the explosion went off, but the guy was flinging himself onto the ground. And other stuff we've seen, like the example you provided, was this supposed IED attack, where there was immediately lots of people invited to go and look at the scene. But one guy called Patrick Lancaster, who's basically this basically a Western video blogger who's been hanging out with the separatists and, you know, decided he's a journalist now, filmed the inside of the car where he focused on the corpses and was saying, you know, how awful it is that these poor people died. But as you were saying, one of them had a bullet exit wound there, and then a very distinct cut that had been done by a bone saw to remove the skull cap during an autopsy. And it also looks like his chest cavity had been autopsied as well. It may even have been a medical cadaver. And we spoke to experts who were very familiar with autopsies, and they said this is 100%. You can even see like where the bone saw is kind of jammed and it's been cutting through the bone.
Was Patrick Lancaster putting this video out as part of their ops, or was it his, did he notice the rectangular hole in the head?
No, he thought it was a genuine scene, and he was quite insistent afterwards, even when people were pointing to like medical records that, you know, show that this is how you do an autopsy, that it must have been from shrapnel or the heat cracking the skull open. But we ran that past, you know, experts, and they said
Assume if you like Patrick Lancaster, but if ever there was a useful idiot, tis thee.
Well, yeah, this is the thing. You get these, the separatists kind of get relationship with these kind of, video bloggers, and they have since 2014, when, you know, since the original conflict, and they start kind of, you know, hanging out with the separatists, and they get very comfortable. So they always get invited to these kind of scenes of crime, and they document everything. And then we look what they actually provide us as investigators with much better access to the kind of scene of crime than we could hope from any of the kind of reporters, because the kind of experienced Russian reporters know not to film too much and give stuff away. But these guys, they'll point their camera at every little thing and obsess over things. Like, there's loads of holes in the side of the vehicle that looked very much like bullet holes rather than shrapnel holes. And I've spent a lot of time looking at IED explosions and vehicles that have been attacked by them. And it looks more to me more like they set up a car with a couple of corpses in it, set it on fire, and then fired an AK-47 into the side of it or something to simulate it, and then set off an explosive at the side of the road to pretend that's the IED that went off. But it's just one of, a number of examples we found where there's been fabrications or some misleading thing. You know, when we had the on February 16th, or February 18th rather, we had the announcements from the head of the Luhansk People Republic and Donetsk People Republic that they were evacuating the local people because of shelling that had been happening, and that they were blaming on the Ukrainians. And it turned out the metadata in those videos, again from Telegram, show they were both filmed on the 16th of February before the shelling supposedly occurred. So that was another, creating a narrative so they could then evacuate people from Donetsk and put them in refugee camps inside Russia, and then have the Russian media come and film the terrible situation there. And this is really intended for the Russian media. But I think really what's been interesting for me with this compared to 2014 is how prepared the online network of various individuals interested in open source investigation who have been doing geolocation and those kind of things on a range of different topics that really didn't exist in 2014 is now really well established. So now we're seeing all these videos coming out from Ukraine that are being very, very rapidly geolocated and verified. And that allows us to actually use that information, verify it very quickly because we have coordinates we can check on satellite imagery and actually get that information verified and out there to, I think, a news media and a policymakers and other people who are really raring to see this stuff come from us, because they know our reputation. They also know the value of this material, and they know how we've covered conflict in the past. So I think there's this real great interest in how, this community has formed over the last several years, and is now actually being really, really, really effective at, debunking stuff, but also verifying the stuff that's happening on the ground.
How do you explain the fact, the Soviet Union, the Russians, are obviously quite sophisticated in cyber warfare. How come they're such dumb klutzes with this stuff? I mean, they've got brilliant actors, they've got brilliant film directors, and they come out with stuff that makes the Keystone Commissars, I've started calling them. They really are idiots in the stuff that they're putting out.
I think maybe part of what it is you can't really get the staff is one of the issues. I mean, it might be, this is a GRU-led information operation, but they still need people on the ground in separatist-held areas to fake this stuff. And these guys, don't know what they're doing. They don't know what people like us will be looking for in these films. They don't realise that we've seen plenty of IED explosions.
In fact, you just mentioned, I did notice there was an IED, one of the cars blown up, and it was next to a shop window that was still intact. Allegedly, as far as
This is the thing.
I mean, that's sort of elementary. You don't have to be a sophisticated intelligence officer to think, whoops, if a bomb had gone off, maybe that window would have had a dent or two in it.
And a lot of it is about throwing as much at the wall as possible and seeing what sticks. And in the past, that's been very effective because it's taking a while for that stuff to be debunked and investigated, because there hasn't been that community of people ready to pick stuff apart. But that community exists now. So, we were looking at one video yesterday that supposedly showed a Ukrainian border excursion into Russia. And we discovered it was basically filmed in the heart of separatist territory on the border with Russia. And it was just completely ridiculous. But we did that within an hour. So the cycle it takes for this stuff to get into the news media and to be discussed is being broken up by the fact that now we can just get onto it so quickly. It's very hard for them to, I think, effectively just respond to that. And I think that's been really shifted for me, or I've at least seen the way you have, say, a community of people in the West who I would describe themselves as anti-imperialists, but more anti-US than anything. And they're very active. They have their own websites and stuff like that. But I think they found it a bit difficult to get a grip on narratives, because they're leading more on the broader Ukraine is run by Nazis and ignoring the fact that the president's Jewish and, believing that spin from the Russians. But at the same time,
Putin's best friend in Hungary, Viktor Orban, is a card-carrying Iron Cross member, hangover from Nazi era in Hungary.
So what they're trying to do is, grab onto something that's like an allegation or claim. But the problem is they can't really do that because by the time they find it, it's already been debunked. Before, you didn't really have that. So I think those narratives were able to kind of settle with that community, and they would then cling on to those narratives. Like with MH17, when the community was focused so much on it being an Su-25 from Ukraine shooting down MH17, and they spent 2 years doing everything they could to justify that position. But now it's like within an hour, something's been debunked, and you know it takes them 6 hours to actually figure out that thing exists because they aren't really engaged in the way the kind of open source community is. But for the what you're also seeing is that because you have this kind of network of people, you know, all over the internet who are kind of part of this open source community in, you know, in different ways. Some are like Bellingcat, are obviously very active in gathering and investigating. Some are just people who are just sharing videos with other people who see it. And then in a way, those videos kind of bubble to the top of the kind of pile where they are analyzed and then kind of, you know, picked apart if they're fake or, you know, geolocated or whatever it may be. And because that's happening so rapidly, it's almost as if we don't have to dig too deeply to find any material because this whole community of people find it and put it straight in front of us and they, hey, look at this. And then we can find it quite easily. Or it's just the kind of just observing the community, you know, being on Twitter and just seeing all these videos kind of appearing. And half the time when they appear, someone's already gone in and geolocated them just because they are sharing them because they've geolocated it. So, or if you go on Twitter and search for the word geolocation or geolocated, you see loads of videos now from Ukraine with coordinates on that people have found. And that's not to say we should take this stuff at face value, but once you have those coordinates, it makes the geolocation a lot easier. And I think also, in a sense, a lot of the members of that community who do that understand how to make that more accessible. So they'll include the kind of satellite imagery and the, you know, photograph with all the colored boxes on it, like we'd like to use to show, you know, prove the match. So that in a way makes our life a lot easier. And because I think we're almost like in a gatekeeper position that I think previously was kind of, you know, held by more traditional media sources. But we're now, because we're gathering all this information from all over the internet, and then we kind of put the Bellingcat stamp of approval on, you know, a geolocation, that then gets spread very widely. And I've certainly seen a massive interest in the work that Bellingcat's been doing, you know, through this, both the debunking the disinformation, but also verifying the kind of content that's coming out from the conflict.
Well, this is one of the, you mentioned the traditional media. One of the problems with the traditional media, and most of us, it's in the Western liberal tradition, we always assume that there are two sides to questions and you look at them. So, you know, people have been bending over backwards to think, well, you know, Putin must have something on his side and, you know, maybe it's true and we should weigh them all up. And, you know, I was a very vociferous opponent of the Iraq War and the Vietnam War and many other wars as well. But on this one, they don't seem to have any sense of perspective on this. And they, you know, in a sense, the Russian InfoWars people are using our own liberal instincts against ourselves, that we think they have a side and they should be allowed to put it.
It's like a bad parody. Yeah, it's like a bad parody of previous kind of NATO and US-led conflicts. They're trying to use this kind of idea of a right to protect, but that seems to have been almost abandoned in the last few days when now the talk is more about, you know, Putin gave that insane speech where he was talking about the Russian Empire and how Ukraine wasn't a real country. And it was almost as if they had all these fig leaves prepared and then he was just like, nah, chuck them out the window. This is what it's really about. And that's probably the most honest we've seen him talking about the conflict. I mean, now, of course, the kind of primary narratives appear to be, A, they're trying to protect the people in Luhansk and Donetsk from kind of these fabricated...
Which is hence the evidence to prove that those people are under threat.
Yeah, and also that the country, they're trying to denazify kind of... the country, which is really, you know, is their music kind of exaggerated? I mean, there is a far right problem in Ukraine, that's certainly true, but it's certainly not to the point where they run the country or anything like that, which I think is what's trying to be pushed by you know, Russia and their
support. An outsider might think the US is run by the Ku Klux Klan. In fact, sometimes I tend to view myself in recent years, but it would be a parody to, you know, to make it as a definitive political statement.
Well, yeah, and especially to invade another state and, you know, overthrow its, you know, government when the president is Jewish. It's kind of like it makes it rather obvious that this is just kind of a
lie.
Yes. But yeah, this is really about, you know, just basically Russian imperialism, which is makes it weird to see the kind of these anti-imperialists or self-declared anti-imperialists kind of siding with Russia over this. And it makes it clear that their kind of perspective is really one of kind of anti kind of Americanism and anti-Westernism. That they've kind of just then, I mean, there's reasons for that. You know, a lot of it is fueled by their kind of anger at the invasion of Iraq in 2003. But, you know, looking at what, you know, if they're angry about a country fabricating a, you know, reason to invade a country, then really they should be extremely angry at what Russia's doing. But because of their political viewpoint, they only see things through the lens of what happened in Iraq in 2003 and see the West as the bad guys in all scenarios. Therefore, anyone on the other side of it, in this case, Russia, must be the good guy. But I don't think those voices at the moment are really having any kind of impact in the debate at all.
You haven't heard Tucker Carlson?
Oh, well, there's Tucker Carlson as well. I mean, I think Fox News in itself, though, is
Laura Ingraham.
Yeah, that Fox News is a kind of unique ecosystem, I think, unto itself, especially in the American context. Hopefully it'll stay unique. But I just don't get the impression, or yet at least, you've seen this kind of, I think partly because it's in a sense happened. You know, if you're watching it, it's happened quite slowly in a sense, but for most observers, it's something that's happened very, very, well, not non-observers in a way.
Well, you see the usual suspects trying to get demonstrations on the street. Stop NATO's war.
Yeah, and it's just...
We cannot tell a lie. 200,000 Russians were brutally attacked by NATO.
Yeah, it's kind of just... It's just, I think it reveals how unprepared they are as a community to actually understand... the conflict in their own way and kind of have narratives around it, because I think to most average observers what you're seeing is outside of Russia, because they're, you know, obviously they've got the Russian media telling them a different narrative, but it seems very clear that, you know, this is a Russian war of aggression. And I think a big part of that has been the way in which we've been able to look at the kind of content that's been coming out, particularly in the last week prior to the invasion happening, that was able to be very clearly debunked. And there were very clear, except multiple clear examples of, you know, separatists producing fake justification for war. And because the news media, I think, was prepared to kind of report on that, which they kind of weren't back in 2014. And the fact this stuff was being debunked within a news cycle, I think, is also very important. And the kind of online news cycle, not just the kind of 24-hour news cycle, made it, in a way, more possible to actually shape the narrative around what was actually happening rather than, you know, the unanswered questions around what was happening. We could kind of answer the questions of, is this video real? Is this claim fake? Which I think in back in 2014, I mean, looking at what we did with MH17, there was still, you know, sometimes days and weeks between something happening and us being able to disprove it. And that makes all the difference, I think, when you're seeing a conflict develop in this way. And I think it has made a lot of difference in a conflict that has developed so rapidly over the last couple of weeks, where these narratives have really shot through the window, shot up through the sky. And, you know, we've had, you know, a clear attempt to build a narrative by Russia around a conflict that I don't think most people have brought outside of Russia. But inside Russia, it has been effective because they're constantly being bombarded by these images that reinforce the idea that there's this kind of, you know, this issue in Eastern Ukraine of ethnic cleansing of Russian, ethnic Russians, that doesn't really exist in the way they do. But because, you know, if you're seeing 10 reports in one news program that say, you know, Ukraine's ethnically cleansing Russia, and you think, well, one of them might not be true, but what about those other nine?
And the president of Ukraine himself is a native Russian speaker who's Ukrainian, is by all accounts a bit rusty.
Yeah, and it's just now, I think what we're seeing is, obviously with the invasion, we're going to start seeing a shift in the kind of disinformation that we're going to see. There's, of course, the kind of usual kind of military disinformation, which is our troops aren't there. They're, you know, they're trying to hide where their troops are, which is, you know, it's part of warfare. But as we start, I think, seeing more potential war crimes and violations of international humanitarian law, we'll see exactly what we saw with Syria, where we started seeing Russia putting out forgeries and various fakes to claim it didn't do anything there. And to a degree, they kind of got away with that because there were very few organizations who were focused on Syrian fact-checking this stuff. And I have plenty of examples of Russia lying about stuff, but they never really got kind of media pickup because it wasn't really the thing the media were interested in at that point in time. Ukraine, though, is completely different. We have a great deal of interest in the conflict. We have a great deal of interest in what open source investigation can produce. We have a way to produce that in a fairly kind of short order and, you know, get that out there very, very quickly. And I think there's journalists who are kind of watching, you know, our work very closely to understand what's happening in this. So when Russia comes out with its kind of fake satellite imagery and, you know, fake claims, as it has done repeatedly in the past, and that I expect they will do in the future, I think it's going to actually be a lot easier to very rapidly debunk those. And there's, even if we don't do it, there's a whole community of people who will be raring to be the first people to, you know, fact check something and prove that it's actually untrue. And with Russia's past track records, there's going to be plenty of that to do.
There's going to be, they've got a sort of skepticism barrier to climb. I mean, yeah, I thought the height of chutzpah was when they started claiming that the Srebrenica as an excuse. This was a massacre which their puppets denied happened. They, you know, basically the Serb parody is that all of those Bosnians killed themselves to make the Serbs look bad.
And, well, this is kind of why I think a lot of what they're doing, it almost seems like they're, all the stuff they've been mad about in the past, they're now kind of using as an excuse to attack Ukraine, as almost as if they're kind of trolling from the West, saying, well, now it's our right to protect. Look at, you know, this ethnic cleansing that's happening. And what also seems to be coming across to me is the way they fake stuff and the kind of claims they make are the stuff they accuse other people of faking. Like there's this been building this narrative around chemical attacks being done by the Ukrainians that is, you know, they're fabricating. I mean, they produced this fake video of this attack on this kind of chlorine storage as part of that. But it's almost as if they've got the idea from what they think other people are doing in other conflicts, or at least what they claim other people are doing in other conflicts. And now they're using that as their kind of disinformation in their own conflict. And the thing with Russia, I find, is that I think a lot of the people within the Russian bureaucracy and the military and elsewhere truly believe that these things, you know, happening in Syria, like chemical attacks, are lies and disinformation. And, you know, the white helmets are all terrorists and stuff like that. I mean, even today they brought up the white helmets in regards to Ukraine, saying that the West is going to try and do what they did with white helmets in Syria with Ukraine and falsify all these attacks and these things. So it seems they're kind of drawing on their own history of conflict, but their own history of conflict is so kind of warped by their own disinformation and the way that disinformation has become kind of, in some minds, I think, mainstream thinking. They don't even realize it's disinformation. I mean, an example of that is a couple of years ago, a news crew went to Moscow University to film the kind of the students who will be the next kind of Russian bureaucrats who will be moving into working at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and MOD. And they had a former FSB guy there doing a lecture, and he was talking about Bellingcat, and he was talking about saying that Bellingcat is part of the UK security services and is, you know, creating disinformation. Now you're telling that to students, they're going off to join the government believing that's a fact, and then they're basing their behavior off basically faulty information. And if you imagine that happening kind of on a large scale with all kinds of disinformation that kind of, you know, these professors are repeating to their students, then you end up with students who believe a completely warped and false version of reality. But when that meets kind of fact checking and verification and the kind of work that we're doing, they seem to be coming rather unstuck. And I was kind of most surprised, genuinely like shocked, that Russia had not improved the quality of its disinformation. You know, I was expecting we'd be seeing like much more sophisticated campaigns, it'll be a lot smarter. And really it was like almost a regression. And it was so dumb in so many cases that I started to doubt myself. I thought, surely this can't be that stupid, because it just was, they've seen what we've done in the past and how we do our work, yet they're repeating the same mistakes and making even bigger mistakes time and time again in just like a week-long period during like what's supposed to be the build-up to, you know, he's definitely going to be a major invasion and attack, an attempt to annex a, you know, a complete country. And instead we saw, you know, metadata that revealed all kinds of lies, and just, you know, they were going to the, you know, the lengths of kind of bussing people out of Donetsk into refugee camps, but the videos they were using to do that had metadata on that proved that it was all a, you know, a fabrication. And you would think they were a bit more sophisticated than that, but no, they're not. They've not appeared to have learned any lessons. Maybe we'll see a difference now Russia is directly involved in, you know, an invasion, but I really, really don't think we're going to see that.
So you've, aren't you at risk? Do you go near people with umbrellas with pointy tips, for example? Are there any direct threats to you? I mean, these are ruthless, evil people. They've, you know, they've poisoned, they've gone into people's homes to poison them. They've injected people with poisons. They've tried to withhold medical treatment from people they've poisoned. There really does seem to be no bounds left for them. So aren't you?
Well, I mean, we are concerned. I mean, my colleague Christo Grozev, he does a lot on the investigations, and there'll be stuff coming out fairly soon that will kind of reveal the threats he's been under. It's not public yet, but it will be soon. From my side, I mean, I have the British Counterterrorism Police in contact with me. I have like a special number I phone if I'm ever in danger. There's like, if anyone calls about my house, there's kind of like notes on the system, which probably say things like
that. That's worrying. Being protected by Boris Johnson is a worry.
Shit. but it is a concern. And I mean, we know for a fact, based off our research, that Russia runs a assassination program that targets both domestic opponents and foreign opponents, that they've successfully assassinated people on multiple occasions. I think we're up to 20 assassinations that we've managed to document. And we're sure that's just the tip of the iceberg. It's just what we've been managed to figure out from the information we've got. And we're like, we've got like two people working on that. So God knows what else they're up to. You know, they've been developing a nerve agent program that is specifically designed for assassinations. You know, part of that is designing a release mechanism that delays the release of the poison for several hours, which is why the Skripals and the Navalny poisoning didn't happen immediately. It was like a delay between exposure. And, you know, we've evidenced that's the case. And it's clearly designed around assassinations. And that's just the poisoning. And we've got this assassination squad that's been going around Europe assassinating Chechen dissidents. The Berlin Tiergarten case being the big example of that, where, you know, that was a conviction last year that was partly based off the work of Bellingcat. But this is not just one killing, it's multiple killings over a period of more than a decade by the same team. And time again, when we find one murder or assassination, there's going to be a bunch more behind that that we start unpicking. And yeah, even, you know, in the coming weeks, we've got more of those that we'll be publishing about. But it's really just the scale of this program is quite shocking. And I think, I mean, the time is going to be interesting because of also what's happening with Ukraine and the extra attention on Russia. But I think what we'll be revealing in the coming weeks will be very significant, both abroad and also inside Russia. But I can't give any more details of that at the moment. But hopefully towards the end of March, you'll see some very interesting stories coming from us.
If there's any of the participants who want to put in a question, if you could put it in the chat or the Q&A while we continue discussing the larger issues here. Are we going to see sort of videos soon of happy pig farmers in the newly Russified Ukraine celebrating the great leader coming to look after them? I mean, I almost envisage North Korean style as Putin comes in and gets adoration from the adoring Ukrainian masses.
I think it depends how it's going to go. It seems to me they're trying to capture Kiev as quickly as possible. You may have seen today reporting that the airport near Kiev was attacked by Russian forces in a you know, by helicopters and special forces. That seems to be an attempt to create a staging area for a further attack on Kiev. And I think they're really trying to get Kiev taken by Monday. I think they're really pushing to, you know, decapitate the Kiev.
And what about Odessa? I mean, there's several speculations from strategists about the attempts to control the mouth of the Dnieper on the Black Sea.
I think they're attacking from multiple directions, but I think they're trying to kind of, you know, decapitate the head of the snake and then kind of capture the rest of the country afterwards once everything falls apart there. So it's really going to come down to how quickly they can secure a victory. And if it's very rapid, Putin is going to use this as a massive, you know, he's going to consider himself a hero and make sure the media is displaying, you know, showing him as a hero inside Russia. If it takes longer than that, then it might be more of a problem for him. But if it's a very short victory, I'm sure by, you know, Tuesday next week, we'll have Putin visiting the country and waving at adoring crowds who've been bussed in from Russia and, you know, that kind of thing. So, and Also, if you just win the, if this is a very rapid victory, it's going to really worry a lot of these nations that have frozen conflicts, Moldova and Georgia, where there's a Russian-backed frozen conflict. And I think it's going to, I think a lot of this is going to depend on the reaction of the West. I think unless the kind of reaction, which needs, I think, to be extremely stringent sanctions against Putin's inner circle, that affects his inner circle directly, that affects Putin directly, but also broader economic sanctions. I think it's just going to basically be seen as a green light by Putin to start doing the same with other countries. That
well, so far, the cyber war seems to be asymmetrical. The Russians have been quite clearly engaged in cyber probes and cyber attacks against Western targets. There doesn't seem to be much in return. I mean, you know, the Israelis and the Americans did go against Iran with cyber warfare, and you know, which is one of the reasons why they can't be so pious about how shocking all of this is. But what potential weapons could the West, which after all invented most of this technology, use against Russia? Is it just that Russia's not as dependent on the technology as the West, or, you know, can their banking system be screwed up? Can everything else, you know, this time we're serious sort of thing?
The thing is, I think it's easier, well, not easier, but kind of more palatable to do stuff that's above the board rather than cyber attacks that might target kind of infrastructure, be it financial or industrial infrastructure, because, you know, there is so much Russian money in the West. But the question is then, you know, it's like there's a huge amount of kind of Russian money in London, but does Boris Johnson really at this particular moment in time want to lose all that money?
Well, he hasn't sent any of the donations back.
Well, yeah, he's got too many donations that he has to worry about as well. I think, though, that, I mean, it was certainly just before the initial kind of invasion, there was this kind of big push for sanctions, and things like Nord Stream 2 being paused was quite significant. And if you look at the stock market in Russia at the moment, you're seeing they're having their own problems there with the events that are unfolding. But I think a lot of it will depend very much on how quickly this conflict is over. If they are successful in their strategy and they do quickly, you know, take control of the country, that may lessen some of the damage. But then I think that will require an even more kind of stronger sanctions-led approach to what happens next. But I think a lot of it will really be decided over what happens over the next 3 or 4 days. And if we still see things seem not to be moving very rapidly by Monday, then I think that's where we might start seeing that Putin has felt he's overreached. And it will give, I mean, it's frustrating that, you know, we've had the invasion, and I've been offline for an hour or two, but I still haven't seen any sanctions put in place. It still seems they're being debated. And, you know, I think that should have happened the moment a Russian soldier stepped into Ukraine. All those sanctions should have been in place, because now it just looks like, you know, we're ill prepared for this, even though we
knew it was coming all along. So if it goes, one of the issues that comes up, again, battling with our own liberal sort of self-perception, is like in the UK, they're discussing treating Russia Today, Novosti, as a hostile agents. You know, my instinct on this would be to say no, but I mean, my experience of these is that, yes, they are hostile agents. They've never carried a contrary opinion, ever. I know. In contrast, of all places, the Iranians, who are banned, I've been on Press TV and I've told Press TV that they shouldn't have nuclear, they shouldn't have a nuclear, civil nuclear program, let alone, I've suggested that that they are supporting a murderous dictator in Syria. And they called me back. Russia Today, once I said something like this and that was gone. Never.
Yeah, they won't have you back.
The phone was dead.
It has been quite interesting, because I've noticed a couple of Russia Today journalists struggling a little bit, kind of after hearing Putin basically saying, I love Russian imperialism, then kind of coming back. Because a lot of those kind of people who work there come from a very strongly, or what they think is a strong kind of anti-imperialist background. So they're having a bit of trouble, I think, you know, doing the math on that one.
Well, George Galloway could consider that Saddam Hussein was indefatigable, brilliant leader, so he should have no problems with Putin.
Yeah, I think it's more kind of on the production side, because I think the thing with Russia Today, I've spoken to quite a lot of Russia Today and former Russia Today people who aren't 100% happy that they're stuck there for the rest of their career because no one else wants to hire them. And they certainly, you know, are very uncomfortable at the best of times with some of the stuff they do. But I think in these circumstances, I think it's similar to with MH17, where we did have, you know, Russia Today reporters kind of resigning on there, that this may be pushing them a bit harder than they would out of their comfort zones. I mean, they're happy to kind of, you know, talk about US imperialism and, you know, how terrible the West is and how acid really isn't that bad a guy and all the chemical weapons attacks are fake. But when you've got Putin going, oh, I miss the Russian Empire, you know, for 45 minutes, it's a little bit more difficult to ignore that because, you know, his own words kind of betray.
But if sanctions mean they don't get paid, will they reconsider their
this is the other thing as well.
They foolish attachment.
I mean, there's a question as well I've seen in Parliament of saying, you know, some people saying, oh, we should ban Russia Today in the UK. And I think that's that might be a fun idea. But I think the long term consequences of that would be more that the BBC would get kicked out of Russia, like we've seen with Germany when they shut down Russia Today Germany because of their lack of licensing. If we just boot Russia Today out of the UK because of what Putin's done in Ukraine, then there's no more BBC in the in Russia, all of their correspondents will be kicked out. We've already seen, you know, one kicked out.
But we see that in the US because they've put restrictions on Russian and Chinese news agencies and don't seem to think that maybe other people look at the BBC and the and the Voice of America in the same way. Oh, but they're independent.
Well, we've had our own problems because of that, actually. Because of the Foreign Registration Act, Agent Registration Act in the US, Russia started using their own foreign agent status against various organizations who are funded from abroad in Russia. And we've actually been targeted by that same Russian law. We are now a foreign agent in Russia, even though we have no presence whatsoever in Russia. And we're currently fighting through the... We call it a fight, but there's two sides, you know, who get to fight in a fight. It's battling through the Russian legal system to challenge it so we can take it to the European Court of Human Rights. And our position is, under Russian law, you can't have be forced to take part in economic activity. And we're being forced to basically set up a company inside Russia so they can fine us when we don't put the warnings saying that we're a foreign agent on our work, which is something we'll never do. But, you know, they're going after it. And the thing is, they can escalate that and cause an undesirable organization, which would then have an impact on anyone who works with us or funds us or is involved with us in any way. And that would put them in legal jeopardy inside Russia. And some of our partners are, you know, organizations that do work in Russia, or we, you know, have some contributors who live in Russia. And that kind of use of Russia, of this kind of perversion of what the FAR Act was originally intended for, to target independent news agencies, is something that they've been quite rampant with, especially since May 2020, when I think, or 21, COVID, you forget which year it is. It's something they've really, since May 2021, they've really gone after civil society in a way that we've not seen before. And maybe it was an attempt to lay some ground for what they plan to do in Ukraine now. But yeah, I'm currently being sued by Yevgeny Prigozhin, aka Putin's chef, for saying that he works with Wagner, or he's involved with Wagner, even though he's been sanctioned in the UK, EU and US for that very same thing. He says that I'm damaging his reputation by tweeting about it four times. So I'm currently going through the UK.
He's suing in the Russian courts, is he?
No, UK courts, which makes it even more. The thing is, he had to get special dispensation from the Home Office in the UK to allow him to pay his lawyer to sue me for the reason he was sanctioned in the first place. So I'm going through this process. Unfortunately, it's going our way.
I hope the Home Office is paying your costs then, since they've inflicted this wound on you.
Well, sadly not. I mean, we are covering the costs through Bellingcat, but it's still, I mean, that's money we could be spending on investigations. But yeah, and it's, you know, from the legal side of things, it's you know, time and time again. Actually, he's actually suing us separately in Russia now, because we implied in an article that he's connected to Wagner. And we're kind of getting at the point is, do we even want to bother challenging this stuff in a Russian court? Because we know we'll lose, and then we have to spend money to lose in an unfair court.
Well, there go your ruble accounts.
Well, yeah, all my rubles are going to be gone, all my many rubles. But it's frustrating, but it is kind of... there are people who are going through much, much worse. So I don't want to complain too much about it, but it is just a reflection of how Russia is going after journalists, not only at home now, but also abroad.
Just looking forward, we haven't got that much time left, but looking to the future and considering worst case scenarios, if there's a Russian occupation, then what's the prospects for the flow of information for the internet and telephone lines, satellites, etc., to keep information flowing out of there on what's happening inside?
Well, it's very difficult to restrict the sharing of information from a conflict zone that's already so well connected to the internet. I mean, there's been attempts to shut down the internet in other conflicts to varying degrees of success. But even in Syria, where there was, you know, internet cut off, it was still information was coming from that conflict, you know, a lot of information. I think really what we're going to be seeing is, if this conflict goes on for a long time, documenting war crimes and stuff like that will become a priority, and open source information will be very useful for that. But we will have journalists on the ground who are capturing information. NGOs will be out there as well. So that combination of information, I think, will make it easier to investigate war crimes committed by forces fighting in the conflict. If they do basically occupy the whole country, even then, it's going to be very difficult for any country or any modern country to, you know, survive without an internet. And people will still be able to cross the border into other countries and carry stuff with them.
What about satellite information? I mean, some of the information that's come here has been on Russian troop movements, for example, on the incidents that have been reported, have been debunked with satellite imagery.
Yeah, and what's been really interesting is we're seeing people like Maxar, who have been, you know, providing this imagery for free, which has been very useful for our understanding of the buildup of the conflict. I'm hoping in the long term that they'll have a deal with Google Earth to actually put that stuff on there, because we found that kind of imagery very, very useful when we were looking into the conflict back then.
And so we're hopeful that they will continue.
Yeah.
So any other thoughts on... any news from Odessa that you've seen that's been...
Well, yes, I mean, we've been... we're looking at the various incidents. I mean, we've seen a few incidents today where there's been civilian casualties, although it seems like most of the combat has been focused on key infrastructure that they're capturing for kind of, staging and undermining the Ukrainian forces.
This would be caused by the American troops that Trump said were invading Odessa.
Well, yeah, he claimed to say that. On the questions people have, people are asking if Russians using the statements by useful American idiots to buttress this case. I mean, we've seen Tucker Carlson's comments being translated and broadcast on Russian television with subtitles. So they're certainly using stuff like that. And I expect more of that to happen if they keep saying that stuff, because they love to have Americans saying how right they are about things. And can we expect protests in Russia when their forces begin to get killed? The thing is, we're seeing protests now in Russia, and the police are immediately arresting people. Like, as soon as people stand in one place for too long, they're getting arrested for protests. So whilst there might be attempts to protest, they will be cracked down on very quickly. But I think maybe if it does become a long-term conflict, it's not like 2014, when Russia was pretending there weren't even any Russian conflict happening. It was all Ukrainian. This is different. We know Russian troops are there. It's not something that's hidden. And we're already seeing captured and killed Russian troops appearing in social media posts. So it's not going to be something that can remain hidden for long.
Okay. I think we're getting towards the end. Thanks very much for this very useful update at a time of deep crisis. It's not quite as bad as I thought this morning. You can't help wondering, nuclear powers, mushroom clouds, if somebody is mad enough to do this, then are they mad enough to pull the trigger? And the consequences are pretty awesome. Without panic, you've got serious grounds for apprehension and high blood pressure looking at the possible consequences. But thank you very much, and I hope you stay safe and stay away from pointy umbrellas and people spotting cathedrals in your vicinity and so on. Because they really hate you. The useful idiots hate you so much. It reaffirms my admiration for your work every time they're launching with another attack. But thank you very much to Elliot Higgins. Thank you very much for attending, everybody. And we hope to see you soon. Incidentally, on March the 2nd, we have almost the roots of this. My friend Tinatin Chaparidzada has just written a book about the legacy of Stalin in Russia, which many years in the making, just been published, and extremely timely, I think. And she will be in 2 weeks' time, I think it is, March the 2nd. So please come in for that. We'll be getting the details out soon. And Stalin might have been nasty, but he was no idiot. I think he'd have done better than this, a little bit. But I don't want to sing his praises. But this is a pathetic performance by Russian InfoWars Department. Don't hire Russian spies to run your TV and information wars. Thanks very much, Elliot. I'll see you soon, I hope.
Thank you.
Good luck. Bye. Thank you.